What better today, friend? Welcome to the Advantage Joy at Work podcast. I'm thrilled that you've joined me here as I help marketplace leaders unstuck their true potential to thrive in life and leadership, to build successful, sustainable business with collaborative, high-performance teams and joy at work with practical, neuroscience-based advantage guides and coaching. If you need an outside voice with a fresh perspective to challenge and empower you, your team, or business to a new level of performance and engagement, then let's talk now. Fear, stress, anxiety, and depression in your brain. We're continuing our series on winning the war in your brain. In our last edition, we learned that fear, stress, and anxiety increase when we believe or perceive that our power, influence, or control are diminished or threatened by challenges that are beyond our control. Fear, stress, and anxiety are reactions. They're not illnesses. We have shifted our locus of control from us to them. And there are similarities and differences between these reactions. And it's important we understand them so that we can begin to learn how we can control them. Internally, your reaction to fear, stress, and anxiety and depression are similar. Yet there are key differences in the triggers, the effects, and the time frame. Start with fear. Fear is an intense biological response to immediate external threat and a danger to your safety. Your response is usually intense, physical, and very short term. It's usually unsafe, negative, and unpleasant. During the event, time dilates. You see more, you feel more. By the time you think about it, the trigger is in the past, and you may then experience the euphoria of relief and survival. Adrenaline junkies thrive on that high and deliberately seek such challenges. Stress. Stress is your brain's response to mostly externally triggered challenges, changes, demands, or threats. That may trigger a physical response, but it's mostly psychological and short-term. It can be positive and helpful, it's called eustress, or negative and unpleasant, distress. Both eustress and distress are of the moment. They are in the present, they are now. Eustress fires you up, distress shuts you down. Eustress motivates, distress demotivates. While anxiety is the result of internal tensions, fear and stress are externally driven. Anxiety, internal tensions, creating fear about your ability to perform or address a future challenge. Your response may be physical discomfort, mostly mental, such as humiliation or rejection, but it can be very long term if it's left untreated. Depression is an experience where you feel low most of the time and you've lost interest in things you usually enjoy. You may also have changes in your sleep, appetite. You might feel guilty, demotivated, and generally withdraw from others. But what's happening in your brain? In the brain, fear, stress, and anxiety each have specific triggers for an individual, and each have certain reactions. Between trigger and reaction, a lot of what goes on in the brain is remarkably similar. It's worth reminding ourselves that a challenge we consider fearful, someone else may consider a little stressful or even pleasurable. one simple experience I experience on a regular basis. I have a dog. She's a sweet but nervous rescue dog, about the size of a Labrador. Some people find her adorable. Others consider her to be very frightening. On the other hand, some people find snakes to be interesting and pleasant. Whereas I run from them, even videos or images of them. There are six stimuli we're going to be talking about. Firstly, remember your brain's number one job is to keep you not dead. You are constantly scanning your environment for any threat that might compromise that situation, which can be anything that is deemed to threaten your circle of power. And you can go back to the last Advantage guidepost to look at circle of power if you haven't done that yet. Scanning for threats are your five senses, and these have two routes into the brain. Visual and auditory stimuli, sights and sounds, go to the thalamus in the brain. It's like a reception hub. The lobby of an office where incoming visitors are screened and sent to an appropriate office. If the sight or sound is threatening or deemed to be threatening, the amygdalae are signaled. Olfactory and tactile stimuli, smells and touch, have direct access to the amygdalae. That is, they go straight to the amygdalae. That's why you recoil immediately from bad smells or unpleasant touch. Fractionally later, from something you see or hear. Yes, five senses but six stimuli. When they pick up a threat, the information takes one of two routes in your brain. Route one is the shortcut. This is for smell, taste, and touch. These stimuli bypass the thalamus reception desk and gain immediate access to the amygdala. This is why smells in particular can evoke such powerful responses. The amygdala informs other brain structures to respond to that perceived threat. Now, you've got something called your hypothalamus and pituitary gland trigger. And this triggers your adrenal glands to boost your stress hormones, adrenaline and cortisol. Too much cortisol short circuits the hippocampus, where you keep your memories, making it difficult to organize those memories. Your sympathetic nervous system, the SNS, is stimulated, which increases your heart rate and blood pressure. You sweat more, and even your skin tingles, all to prepare your body for action against the threat. Your freeze, fight, or flight response is activated, enabling you to increase your sensory awareness, and you can drink in more detail to better deal with the threat. Meantime, your digestive tract is shut down. This enables you to divert energy from digestion to responding to the threat. You may then evacuate your digestive tract in readiness for a survival response. See, lunch is less important than escaping the lion behind you. Route two, this is what we call the high road. You hear or see something. That information heads to the thalamus, like the reception lobby of your brain, where it registers and is directed where to go. In the case of a sensed threat, that information is sent to the amygdala, which rings the alarm bells down via the locus coeruleus and the sympathetic nervous system, which signal the adrenal glands to release hormones called adrenaline or epinephrine and cortisol. It shifts your heart rate and blood pressure up, shuts down your digestive system, and initiates your freeze, fight, or flight response, just as we did in the shortcut version. Whichever is your most default response to similar situations. The freeze, fight, or flight response. At first, your response to a new challenge is unconscious. Your response to the fear of this new challenge is typified by this thing we call freeze, fight or flight response. Fight time. So you might get angry, blame others, or frozen. You hide your head and pretend the challenge isn't there, hoping someone else will deal with it. Or your mind simply shuts down with the enormity of the challenge. Or flight. You flee the scene and get away from the challenge. And all that happened in an instant without any conscious thinking. That is, your brain and your body have responded to the stimuli before you have consciously thought about it. And this is a good thing. Most of the time. At least in real emergencies, in the workplace jungle, or driving along the street, not so much. It's only after the sympathetic response is activated that your conscious mind gets involved in thinking about this. Some of the sensory information that was sent from the thalamus reception desk on a longer route through the cortex. Here, that sensory information is analysed and it gives meaning to what is seen or heard. If the threat has passed, then the prefrontal cortex, or PFC, the executive suite of your brain, is responsible for shutting the fear response down. It's like putting the brakes of a car beside the hot engine. That's the way it is. Stress, or at least stress-inducing hormones, are essential to your survival, even in the modern world. Without cortisol, for example, your blood pressure would drop to dangerously low levels, and without immediate intervention, you die. Too little adrenaline, and you'd probably not react to real threats, and also possibly die. Your brain would have failed its number one task to keep you not dead. Talk about distress, which is the one most people think about when we talk about stress. It's a chronic subset of the fear and anxiety response. It's when our brain's response continues to signal the production of more cortisol and adrenaline. The locus of control has likely shifted external to being at effect, and you believe your circle of power and influence is threatened. Stress manifests in the same way as fear, but it continues for longer and is perpetuated by the cortex, the route 2 high road we described before. That is, your thinking determines that the threat is still present and requires the high alert response, even if your thinking is inaccurate, faulty, or toxic. Yeah, there's an upside of stress. Too little stress and you will be calm. Yeah, brilliant. It's perfectly fine if you intend to be calm and doing little. But if you want to perform, you'll need a little oomph. Eustress, as it is known, is the positive effects of stress. Or rather, when your thinking brain, cortex and PFC, alter the way you think about the negative threat as a positive challenge. That is, your locus of control shifts to being at cause. That is, effectively puts the brakes on an overwhelming stress response to a situation, keeping you in a productive action zone. And again, go and look at the notes to see where this perfect balance is, this arousal state. And it's all down to how you choose to view the challenge. Anxieties and phobias and other toxic thinking. That's the sixth stimuli, by the way. The cortex, and especially the PFC, is where we also find our sixth stimuli. Yeah, your thinking, our thoughts. It's when our internal thoughts and emotions, analysis, interpret stimuli as catastrophic or incorrect or irrational, and they informed the amygdala to commence or perpetuate the fear response. An example would be my phobia for snakes. Even an image of one sends my thoughts into a tizzy and triggers a fear response. Basically, our thoughts can be toxic, unhealthy, and unhelpful. When we worry about something in the future, our thoughts and associated emotions, probably from memories, real or imagined, informs the BED nucleus of the stria terminals, the BNST, to perpetuate that fear response typical of longer-term anxiety. And even though the PFC should put the brakes on because worry about the future does, well, absolutely nothing positive ever, this irrational or stinking thinking is allowed to perpetuate, and hence the BNST gets reinforced to continue the fear response. This gives us the illusion of control we saw earlier. Raw sensory information attached to our emotional response then heads to the memory center of the hippocampus for memory storage. One of the biggest problems that people face, often without realizing it, is that what you fear, you focus on. Yet that is the very thing you fear is something that you instruct your reticular activating system, the RAS, to pay special attention. Without realizing what your fear infects, what you serve and worship, it's the center of your attention. And it becomes your idol. Once the threat is passed, we like to post-rationalize any disproportionate emotional response in a desperate attempt to regain that sense of control and power. This is where some people justify their explosive fit of anger as being righteous or the victim deserved it. Or perhaps you feel guilty, self-criticize for a mistake or behavior because you've achieved less than optimal results. Guilt, oddly, enhances our sense of control. Or perhaps you like to add on some deep shame, complete self-condemnation for your actions or behavior. Possibly the most difficult and painful emotion, causing feelings of disgrace and dishonor to the point where the sufferer may feel that they don't deserve to be helped, even by themselves. Oh yes, and we've got the amygdala hijack. Made famous in his seminal book on emotional intelligence, Daniel Goldman tells us that an amygdala hijack is an intense emotional reaction that is out of proportion to the circumstance. It is most often manifest as anger, even rage, and effectively disables intervention by the prefrontal cortex, cutting across the brain and avoiding feelings of guilt and shame, which might have helped you stop yourself at the time. So the next time you see a road rager, you know what's going on inside the brain. And depression. Anxiety and depression share overlapping symptoms, but where anxiety is a high energy state filled with active worry about the future and often something specific, depression appears as a low energy state where there is a general dread about the present and the future. They can and do coexist in a cycle where anxiety can lead to depression and depression causes further anxiety. Hormonal imbalance has long been considered a major cause of depression, perhaps because this suits the pharmaceuticals industry. However, the neuroscience of depression is much, much more complex than that. Research is showing that depression isn't simply about having too much or too little of a particular brain chemical. The causes of depression are much more complex. May include faulty mood regulation in the brain, genetics, and stressful life events, and continued anxiety. For example, experts believe that stress can suppress the production of new neurons, nerve cells, in the hippocampus, your memory center, which appears to be smaller in depressed people. And activity in the amygdala is higher when a person is sad or clinically depressed. And this continues even after recovery from depression. So allow me to posit a theory that if our cortex adds a little guilt or shame to these events, we might create the perfect brewing conditions for depression. Now, I've got an important note here. If you have experienced anxiety for more than 2 weeks, you should seek professional help and guidance. Depression is deeply unpleasant and sadly pervasive, and it is treatable through counselling and, where appropriate, supported with proper medication. The timeline of fear, stress, anxiety, and depression. As I was researching this, I began to notice a difference in the tense that people use when considering each facet of these phenomena. Fear is in the past. The event has already occurred. I am now reacting to the event. Stress is present. The event is taking place now, and I am responding or reacting to it now. Anxiety is about the future. The event is in the future. I am reacting to or anticipating it now. And depression is future and ongoing. The events are now and in the future. I am feeling unable to respond appropriately now. Let's wrap this part and prepare for some pleasure, happiness and joy, okay? We know that a life without challenges simply doesn't exist. And if it did, it would be a slow tedium with no growth and hence only death. We know that to perform any task, our brain and body require a certain level of stress-inducing hormone. We know that we can feel threatened by anything that appears to take away our power or control over our own life. That can be as real as a lion bearing down on you at high speed as you cross its path, or as innocuous as a beep on a smartphone. We also know that our own thoughts can, and often are, the source of our own worry and anxiety, whether factual, real, or not. The fear response is essential for survival. Less so now, perhaps, than for our cave-dwelling ancestors. However, the Bible tells us to fear not, or similar words, 365 times. That's one for each day of the year. Fortunately, there's also a flip side to life beyond stress and performance. There's pleasure and happiness and even joy this side of heaven. Next Advantage Guidepost, that's what we're going to be doing. It will be time to take a look at joy, happiness, and pleasure in your brain. I'm Dr. John Kenworthy, and it's been my pleasure to share this Joy at Work Advantage Guide with you today. Thank you for joining me and supporting my work. Remember, if you ever think that you might benefit from an outside voice with a fresh perspective to challenge and empower you, your team or your organization to a new level of performance and engagement, then let's talk now. You can follow the link at my website, joyatwork.coach. And if you know someone you know would benefit from this Joy at Work guide, please share this with them either by sharing the podcast link, or if you're listening on the Joy at Work website, it's even easier to just click the share button.